I'm Anne Strainchamps, and welcome to the Best of Our Knowledge. Today, we celebrate an American icon.
The greatest all-around athlete America has ever produced. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Thorpe, All-American.
Jim Thorpe was a Native American athlete who died 70 years ago and is still one of the greatest athletes who ever lived. Maybe the greatest. A legendary pro football player, Olympic gold medals for the U.S., and a Major League Baseball player.
I thought he was a hell of a ball player.
MLB coach Al Schacht.
He could hit a ball as far as anybody. He could run as good as anybody. He was one of the fastest men I ever saw on running the bases. He was fast. Man was a great athlete. He could do anything.
Former President Dwight D. Eisenhower actually played against Thorpe in college.
He can do everything that anybody else can do, and he can do it better. And we saw him, just without the slightest form, just put the football on his foot and kick it out 60 yards and punt. There's no trouble at all. We were standing back there, looked like the, 75 yards. You know, he boom, the ball wasn't spiraling or anything else. Just boom, down there. That's all it was good. He could throw the ball, he could run, he could tackle, he could do anything.
He could do anything. Except outrun racism. As a Native American athlete, Jim Thorpe proved over and over again that he was better than anyone else in the world. Today, Jim Thorpe is having a moment.
He's important to me as a Native man and as a Native youth when I was growing up, just because that representation.
Tall Paul is an Anishinaabe and Oneida hip-hop artist enrolled on the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. And for him, Jim Thorpe was everything.
Born in Indian Territory, Oklahoma, with his twin brother Charlie just south of Belmont's border, in a one-room cabin with the wood stove aroma, not too long before the revolt.
As a kid, I didn't see Native men or Native women on the big screen too often, especially not in an athletic sense. Like, I was watching the NFL, the NBA, never seen any Native superstar athletes. So I got curious and started doing some research and found out about Jim Thorpe in my school library, and that inspired me hearing about him being an Olympic athlete and everything. Even though he's been gone at this point for a long time, I needed somebody to look up to who was Native. And that was important for me as a kid.
If you don't think Jim Thorpe is the greatest athlete of all time, you need to watch this video.
There's a feature-length film in the works. There's a new best-selling biography out.
The greatest athlete
in the world.
One
of the greatest athletes of all time.
Jim Thorpe.
Jim Thorpe.
Just that much better than everybody else.
Wow.
He's popping up in Netflix documentaries and in Hulu's hit series Reservation Dogs.
It doesn't surprise me at all that there are Native kids running around with Jim Thorpe t-shirts on.
Patty Lowe directs the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research at Northwestern University, and she's a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe.
I think young Native kids finding somebody like Jim Thorpe are thinking, hey, I'd like to be able to do something like that and really distinguish myself in some awesome way and have people write songs and write books about me 70 years after my achievements. I think almost any person who follows sports knows the name Jim Thorpe and understands that his story is really part of a larger narrative about America and how we've come to deal with race relations.
So, who was Jim Thorpe? Where did he come from? How did he achieve what he did? Here's Shannon Henry Kleiber with Thorpe's biographer, David Marinus.
What originally drew you to Thorpe? I know you've obviously written about politicians and your sports biographies of Roberto Clemente and Vince Lombardi. What drew you to Jim Thorpe at this moment in time?
I'm always looking for the dramatic arc of a story, just a great story. And then for a way to illuminate history and sociology through that story. Jim Thorpe is both an incredible story of perhaps the greatest athlete ever someone who did things that were unparalleled. No one before had won gold medals in the decathlon and pentathlon, been an All-American football player, the first president of the National Football League, and a Major League Baseball player. And he was also, by the way, a great ballroom dancer and could play ice hockey, and people said he was even good at marbles. You know, he could do sort of anything. So that's part of it, but it was also most important to me was to be able to use his life as a lens looking at the Native American experience. Mm-hmm. And so it was that combination that drew me to Jim Thorpe.
Well, yeah, let's talk more about the Native American experience. The name of your book is Path Lit by Lightning, which is a translation of, how do you pronounce it? Is it Wathohuck?
Wathohuck, yes. Wathohuck. It's most commonly shortened to Bright Path, but I saw a translation of Path Lit by Lightning and I thought, that's illuminating.
Yeah.
You know, that, it's
was that
poetic.
Like a North Star for you, his name, as
yes,
you were working on this book?
Absolutely, it was, in so many different ways. He was born in 1887 in a little cabin near the North Canadian River in Oklahoma. The reason he got that name, I think, was literal. There was a thunderstorm along the North Canadian River the night that he and his, by the way, he was a twin, his twin brother Charlie and he were born. So that's where he got the name Path Lit by Lightning, Wathohuck. But I viewed it as both a description of this incredible, I mean, lightning reflects sort of energy and electricity. It also describes something that is dangerous in a way. And then the word path I like so much because the story of Jim's life is a path of great accomplishment, difficulties, and perseverance. His mother always told him that he was the reincarnation of Black Hawk, who was the greatest Sac and Fox warrior. And so Jim sort of always lived with that in his mind, that he was following the footsteps of Black Hawk.
By the time he was growing up, though, it was the 1890s, and Native people were living under white man's rules.
It was very oppressive.
Patty Lowe again.
The government had the right to tell you where you could live, the religions that you could participate in, and Native religions were not among them. Native governments were illegal. They had the power to tell parents where they could. They had to send their children. They could arbitrarily decide to send the children to boarding school. Every aspect of a Native person's life was controlled by the Commission on Indian Affairs, later the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which during this time was located in the War Department, which tells you something.
Jim Thorpe was among the Native children sent to those Indian boarding schools. He ran away from one, and then wound up at the most famous, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Its founder's motto was "Kill the Indian, save the man." The mission? To Americanize Native children through a military-style program of forced cultural assimilation. Carlisle's coach, Pop Warner, spotted Jim's athletic talent first in track and field, then on the football field and the baseball diamond. In those days, sports was one of the few paths to mainstream achievement even available to Native people.
You know, these athletic fields were the only place where Native people were free to express themselves, to compete against themselves, to compete against white men. Some of them, the sons and grandsons of the military leaders that had fought against those Native men's parents and grandparents. So imagine Jim Thorpe, whose great-grandfather, Black Hawk, was ruthlessly pursued by the American military, and now he's playing against teams from West Point. You know, I can't imagine what must have been going through his head. It must have been, he must have had some pretty interesting thoughts before those games.
Whatever fueled him, everyone who saw him agreed. Jim Thorpe was unstoppable.
Sometimes he would score all the points for his team because he was a running back, he was a kicker, he punted, he drop kicked 70-yard field goals. It's really, really remarkable what he was able to accomplish.
It is July 1912. King Gustav of Sweden officiates at the opening of the newly built Olympic Stadium in Stockholm. It is the sixth revival of the modern Olympic Games. It was the year Hannes Kolomainen of Finland won three gold medals in the 5,000 meters, 10,000 meters, and cross country. But his achievement was surpassed by an American Indian, Jim Thorpe, who won the five-event pentathlon and then would attempt to win the first Olympic decathlon ever held.
Jim started training for the Olympics in the spring of 1912, just a few months before the games began. He'd always been a fast runner. But now he added jumps, hurdles, the shot put, pole vaulting, javelin, discus, hammer. He'd be competing in the five-event pentathlon and in the first-ever decathlon, the most grueling contest in Olympic history. He would win them both, outstripping every other competitor and despite an unexpected handicap.
So he's competing in Stockholm, and he's doing really well. I think it was the last day, and Thorpe was about to do the high jump, and his shoes are missing. Somebody may have taken them, or somebody walked off with them mistakenly, but he doesn't have any shoes. And so Pop Warner finds two mismatched shoes. They're not the right size, so he's got to adjust with a couple of extra socks on one and some jury-rigged cleats. And I think he had to wear two socks on his left foot. And he still performs and he winds up winning. That's a pretty extraordinary story, I think.
There's a photo from that day. It must have been taken shortly after he won. Jim is standing on the field, still in his track clothes, looking directly, almost challengingly, at the camera. You can see muscles clenched in his face. And on his feet, sure enough, two mismatched shoes. There's another moment from that day, also part of the Jim Thorpe legend, about the moment he stepped up to receive his two gold medals from the King of Sweden, David Marinus.
What transpired between Thorpe and King Gustav V during those 15 seconds would become a defining scene of Jim's life. The accepted story goes that the king greeted Thorpe in English by saying, "You, sir, are the greatest athlete in the world." To which Jim replied,
"Thanks, King."
Thanks, King.
Totally inappropriate to address a royal that way, but kind of endearing.
But the question arises, how is this conversation known to have happened? Was it a reasonable, if slightly imprecise, description of what was said, or was it myth?
That's the thing about iconic figures. It can be hard to separate the person from the myth. But how different is a myth, really, from a stereotype? In the press, Jim could be cast as both a heroic athlete and an ignorant rube, brave warrior, or quote-unquote, dumb Indian. The romantic myth and the derogatory stereotype wrapped together. He would be dogged by both throughout his career.
Some of the myths are small, you know, like the myth that Jim Thorpe hit home runs into three different states in one game, Arkansas, Texas, and Oklahoma while playing in Texarkana. It's a great story, but it's geographic impossibility. Mm-hmm. Throughout his life, he had to deal with people who romanticized and diminished him at the same time, people who helped him rise and then turned away from him at the times of his crisis. So I would say the largest myth I deal with is the myth that the white fathers know best.
The legend of Jim Thorpe was born in Stockholm. whose performance there catapulted him to superstardom. But the events that followed would haunt him for the rest of his life. He arrived back in the U.S. a hero, with a ticker tape parade down Broadway and national acclaim. 6 months later, the International Olympic Committee stripped him of his medals.
Could you tell that story a little bit? Because I don't think a lot of people know. I mean, they know he won gold medals in Stockholm, and they were taken away, but why?
Yes. Well, he played Bush League baseball for 2 summers in the Eastern Carolina League. This was in 1909 and 1910, 2 years before the Olympics. It was a period when literally hundreds of college athletes were playing summer baseball for money. Most of them were doing it under aliases. Dwight Eisenhower played in the Kansas State League under the name Wilson. There were so many aliases in the Eastern Carolina League that the joke was they called it the Pocahontas League because everyone was named John Smith. Or another line was, there are more aliases in the Eastern Carolina League than there are aliases for gunmen in New York City. But Jim Thorpe played under the name Jim Thorpe. He never hid it. His name was in the paper in North Carolina for 2 summers, almost every day. But nonetheless, after he won his gold medals, a story broke in the Worcester Telegram in Massachusetts, interviewing one of Thorpe's old coaches from the Eastern Carolina League. And it just broke into this huge scandal from there when the guy said that Jim Thorpe played for him. All of the people who were important to Jim's rise lied about their knowledge of what he was doing to save their own reputations. So Pop Warner, his coach at Carlisle, knew exactly what Thorpe had done. He had sent many of his players down to play baseball before. They were scouted by one of Warner's closest friends. Warner met with Jim several times during the period when he was playing baseball and not at Carlisle, and yet when the story broke, he said he didn't know anything about it. So these people, you know, sort of the white saviors, people who were promoting the purity of amateurism, lied about Thorpe to save their own reputations. George S. Patton was on that Olympic team. He was in the U.S. Army. He participated in the modern pentathlon, which had 5 events that were all military-oriented. And he was getting paid by the Army to practice that for a year before he went to the Olympics, but he wasn't called an amateur. The entire Swedish team was allowed to take off from their jobs for 6 months before the Olympics to just train and still paid full-time. They weren't. So in so many ways, Thorpe was victimized and let down by people around him.
Do you think that he was targeted? I mean, it just seems so many other people didn't have to play by those rules, but they wanted him to play
right
by those rules.
I don't know if he was targeted so much as he was victimized by it, because he was an easy scapegoat for everybody. So that when Pop Warner, for instance, when the scandal broke, Warner actually wrote a letter for Thorpe under Thorpe's name explaining what happened. And the basic defense was, well, he's just a, you know, low the poor Indian. He's just an ignorant native, which was wrong in every respect and insulting. So it was easy to have Jim take the fall.
But I think his story of accomplishing the impossible and then having it taken from you, as he did, distinguishing yourself at the Olympics, having your medals stripped from you for transgressions that nearly every major athlete was doing at that time in history, I think those are the kinds of injustices that really resonate with people.
It wasn't until the summer of 2022, after years of pressure from his family, that the International Olympics Committee finally restored Jim Thorpe's gold medals, 110 years after he won them.
I was happy for Thorpe's family, and I know that there were people in the Native American sports world that were finally satisfied that that had been returned. But, you know, for me, it was just a reminder of how injustice had worked for such a long time.
Sometimes the best form of resistance is remembering. Today, a younger generation of Native activists and artists are rediscovering the story of Jim Thorpe.
As I was writing this album, there were definitely moments of anger.
Take Topol.
Just thinking about all the stuff that Jim Thorpe had to go through, thinking about the boarding school history and how they started, and we had to get our hair chopped off, and we had to speak, look, dress, walk, talk like civilized white people, basically. Yeah, there was some anger there. And that's been the case throughout my whole life, learning about Native history, you know, not even just this album. So, yeah.
Topol is a hip-hop artist. Anishinaabe and Oneida enrolled on the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. His new album is called The Story of Jim Thorpe.
I represent indigenous excellence, effortless, getting it in the kitchen, and I'm chefing this recipe. Rest in peace to ancestors that came before. If you're not aiming for the top, what you aiming for? Waging war since Columbus came on shore. Arrowhead to your head. Nowadays we just aim to four. What you waiting for? I blaze them all, I'm past hot. F you, f your team, f your mascot. Trash talk, talk trash, walk past, but don't look. I can tell by the vibes, I got them all shook. They wrote books but left the truth out. It's all lies. Next summer might bring the coop out. It's all lies on me. T-O-M-Y. And I been fly as equal threat. There's none better. Red poets representative. Word to talk poor. Fourth and goal. Us against all y'all. All y'all.
It's indigenous excellence when we touch down.
Coming up, if what happened to Jim Thorpe during his life makes you angry, wait until you hear what happened after he died. It's a story you could not imagine. Not in a million years. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. From the story of his birth to those mismatched shoes at the Olympics, Jim Thorpe has become a legend. And there are conflicting stories about him, even after his death.
Can you take me back to Jim Thorpe's funeral in 1953? Can you describe what happened then?
They were having the fourth day of ceremonies.
Native American activist Suzanne Schoenharjo talking with Steve Paulson.
The Sac and Fox have their journey to the ancestors' ceremony. Each day stands for something. After everything's been done on the previous 3 days, the fourth day is where his name is returned. So that means it can be used by other people again. It's a good name, can be used by someone else. So that ceremony was in process when his widow, his third wife, came in with large men and some sort of legal paper saying, we can take him. And people picked him up in the casket and took him out and put him in a car, her car, and she drove off. Thorpe had been through many, many ceremonies for other people, of course, and he wanted that ceremony for himself. A traditional Sac and Fox ceremony. That was his wish, and he expressed it to all sorts of family members, to friends, to wives, and that was his plan. He was always going to go home. She put him on ice. She kept buying ice, putting ice inside the casket, draining the casket, driving around. She drove to Pennsylvania. She, I guess, had in her mind that people there would like to pay her for his body. They offered her money. And she made a bargain with them that they would change the name to Jim Thorpe. They would build a mausoleum for him, and happiness would reign. And on the side of the highway, as you're entering Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, is a mausoleum. And it's not in very fine taste. It's a little garish, but I'm sure it attracts the casual tourist who's passing by and makes them wonder, oh, what's that? So he's a tourist trap.
The appropriation, not just of Jim Thorpe's name, but of his actual body, his physical remains, is so obviously a violation and a sickening one. You have to wonder how or why people didn't see that.
Look how the stars shine for you, my one and only you.
But then think about the backdrop. Think about American sports and the racist tradition of derogatory Native American mascots and team names. I'm not going to say them, but you know what I mean. Suzanne Harjo, who's Cheyenne and Hidalgo Muskogee, has been leading the fight against them for decades. She says that those names have genocidal histories that are often hiding in plain sight. Like, for example, the practice of paying bounty hunters to kill Native people and accepting, as proof of death, their literal skin. In the nation's very capital, the NFL team had one of those names, and Suzanne led the fight that finally got them to change it to the Washington Commanders, but not until 2022.
It was inevitable that the name would be changed. It was just a matter of when. It wasn't a matter of if.
Yeah.
And along the way, we've changed over 2,000 of them.
2,000 names of mascots of sports teams, you mean? Or
absolutely.
Other kinds of names as well. Wow. Huh.
At the elementary, the junior school, the middle school, high school, community college level, universities, colleges.
Let me ask about your role in this. You have been an activist for more than 50 years. Why are these changes happening now, after all these years?
Well, because we're still here. We were supposed to be dead, gone, buried, forgotten. But because we're still here, it's kind of a burr under everyone's saddle. And at some point, you just can't ignore living human beings who are saying, we have these treaties, and we've kept them, and you haven't. We have been moved, we've been pushed around, and at some point, everyone has just said, enough's enough. We're not going to do this anymore because we have had really strong ancestors who have given their lives so that we could be here, and really strong ancestors who have made us the people we are, who are here, by saying, do this. Don't let them do that. Be this kind of person. Be this kind of human being. Don't accept this kind of treatment. And when you grow up with grandparents and parents and aunts and uncles who are talking to you in this way, you understand that it's on you.
In this long struggle for Native rights, there is such a sense of generations holding hands, of messages and lessons passed down, and you can see that happening again today with the story of Jim Thorpe, with the way he's re-emerging as a hero and role model for a new generation of Native activists and artists, like the hip-hop artist Tall Paul. Let's go back to Charles Monroe Kane's conversation with him.
Do you remember that first time in the library where you started reading or saw a picture, that famous picture of Jim Thorpe in the Olympics? What was it like the first time you were like, oh my God, this guy is Native American and he's a great athlete?
Yeah, so I was living in this small town at the time called Redwood Falls with my family, and I was down in the library in the school, and I was doing some research, and I was doing some digging, and I found this book on Jim Thorpe. And I'm like, okay, he's Olympic gold medalist, NFL Hall of Famer, played Major League Baseball. All right, I'm going to look into this guy, you know, and I started doing a lot of research on him at that point. But it just felt inspiring to me, you know, because I had never heard of him before. Nobody ever told me about him. I just kind of had to figure out about him myself. And it was powerful to find out that there was somebody out there like that who represented us.
Kick back in my time machine, reminiscing everything was so promising. Siblings let me win so I would feel like I was king. Caught the piskin, ran it in, then I was high as he. Who's kneeled down when I'm crying about the sky to me? Like God the grid, I am about my highest being. Fell in love with the sport when I was high as knees. Then I learned to Jim Thorpe and I knew I could beast. Blow up and get the paper like them Shakopees. Go up to snag the ball on ya like Mice and Flea. Show up, I'll be showing up because I've got to peace. That was the Jim Thorpe effect of my philosophy. But somewhere down the line,
I'm curious about you though, before we kind of go further with Jim Thorpe. What is your story? Like, what's Tall Paul's story? How did you end up being a MC, making an album about Jim Thorpe? What's your path?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in South Minneapolis. Just a little bit of my backstory, you know. Grew up, didn't really know my dad too much. Seen some pictures of me sucking on his toes when I was like 1 or 2 years old. But that was the extent of my knowledge of him. Like, I didn't really know of his existence beyond these funny pictures I seen. Met him a little bit later in life, about 9 years old. Wasn't the greatest experience. I do know him now, and we have a good relationship, but just kind of preface him with that history. And then growing up, bouncing all over the place as a youth with my mom and my brothers and sister, through foster homes, through women's shelters, because my mom had been in some abusive relationships. Just that was kind of my background. I kind of grew up in a negative situation, but I always made the most of it with my friends. We would get out and play big games of football, and I fell in love with football, which is how I found out about Jim Thorpe. And then as I got older, about 14 years old, I started rapping. You know, I started freestyling for my friends, started writing little raps because I was watching MTV music videos, 106 in Park, Freestyle Fridays on BET. So I started getting some exposure to hip hop and rap. Had some struggles with like alcohol for like 5, 6, 7 years, and then I got sober and I needed something to pick up, and I had all that free time open now, so I was like, all right, well, I'm gonna try this rap thing out because it's something that I've always been, something I consider myself to be good at. So I started rapping and I got some beats from local producers, got some studio time. Got into the whole hip-hop thing, and as I progressed throughout it, I was like, well, you know, I connected back to Jim Thorpe, and I made a song about him back about 5 years ago. And I just think it's important to push his legacy. If I can attach him to something like hip-hop, it'll do a lot to make people know about him.
I just needed someone great who looked like me. Jim Thorpe, you could be my Muhammad Ali. Afflicted with addiction, alcoholic like P. No submitting, both spitting up in college like G.
All I hear about is cheese, but the ball long deceased. Man, I wish I could have seen you play ball on TV. I wish that you received the same notoriety the mass media has given all these other athletes. I just needed someone great who looked like me, Jim Thorpe. You could be my Muhammad Ali. Afflicted with addiction, alcoholic like P. No submitting, both spitting up in college like G's. My focus not that, we probably both got B's. You're the star RB. I'd skip the smoke trees. When I finally got sober, I became an MC. Messing up on stage because I care what people think. I needed your influence. I don't care what people think. See, for me to feel great, man, I needed that drink. Graduated school and flushed the lick down a sink. Now I gotta be you for kids who wanna be me.
Woo! Damn, I mean, that's it, right? That's what this interview is totally about. That's what your album is about. I mean, now I gotta be you for kids who wanna be me. You're the legacy of Jim Thorpe, right? I mean, that's how it works, right?
Yeah, I think that is how it works. You know, the so-called passing of the torch. And so are all of the other people out there in the Native community who are doing big things. We are the legacies of our ancestors and elders who did great things before us, for sure.
Coming up, the legacy of Jim Thorpe and the legal battle to repatriate his remains. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Our story of Jim Thorpe continues. A story of Olympic gold medals won and lost, of an incredible career in professional baseball and football, which inevitably came to an end. In his later years, Jim Thorpe struggled to find work. Coaching jobs he dreamed of somehow never materialized. He had stints as a bouncer, security guard, and ditch digger, and he finally wound up in Hollywood, mostly playing American Indian chiefs in westerns. He did get to see a biopic made of his life, starring Burt Lancaster.
Think you can do it right, Pat? Just give me that ball.
Working, sweating, training to go to the Olympics. For what?
But by then he had slipped into alcoholism, and he died destitute in 1953. At which point, as we heard, his third wife shows up at the funeral, kidnaps his body, and sells it to a small town in Pennsylvania for use as a tourist attraction. There just aren't words. Jim's children and the Sac and Fox Nation took the town to court and demanded his body be returned to his homeland for a traditional burial, as he'd requested.
How did the town of Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, respond?
This is Suzanne Harjo again.
Like stuck pigs.
We have no intentions of letting him go. There's no reason for it.
They really did not respond graciously at all. They said, he's ours, we bought him fair and square.
And has the town made money off of this, as far as you know, after all these decades?
I do not know. I would imagine they have, because they fought tooth and nail to keep him there. He's their trophy. This is a time-dishonored practice in America, taking Native body parts and bodies and capturing them and somehow parading them. But I know that after a lot of our massacres and our people were mutilated, and we're still recovering parts of our relatives, our ancestors, from this kind of practice.
You said this is a big deal, this whole story of the push, the move, the campaign to return Jim Thorpe's remains to tribal lands in Oklahoma. Why is this such a big deal about Jim Thorpe in particular?
Until 1989, when we got the repatriation laws that we started working on in 1967, by the way, we were considered under law the archaeological resources of the United States of America. And we wanted to change that. We wanted to humanize ourselves like the rest of the world. We've had the horrors of grave robbing and of people being taken out of their graves after being freshly buried and being beheaded, and then their bodies just left there. I mean, that happened under the color of law, under the Indian crania study of the U.S. Army Surgeon General of the late 1800s. I mean, there's a whole raft of Army officer reports, written reports in the National Anthropological Archives. One of them said, I waited until the cover of darkness, till the grieving family left the graveside, exhumed the body and decapitated it. Now, what they would do is take the head, measure the skull, weigh the brain, and then dip the whole thing in lye.
Wow.
note the measurements and send it as freight to Washington to the Army Surgeon General, or depending on what year it was, the Army Medical Museum and the Smithsonian. Imagine the people coming back to that graveside the next day and finding their beheaded, headless loved one outside the grave. I mean, what would you think?
No, it's absolutely horrible. I mean, it's so horrible. You can't even imagine that.
It's like a scene from a horror movie, except it really happened. America's genocidal war against indigenous people is one of history's worst atrocities on a scale so massive, it's hard to wrap your mind, let alone your heart, around. That's why David Marinus wanted to write Jim Thorpe's biography, because, as he told Shannon, sometimes it's the small details of history that can open up a bigger truth and help you take it in. For example,
I knew that he went to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, but I didn't really know the story of what those boarding schools did. The first set of Native Americans who went there were Lakota Sioux. These kids thought they were going there to die, to show their bravery. Mm-hmm. And many of them did, in fact, die. And when I'm doing a book, I'm always looking for those moments that sort of wash over, history washes over me. And that happened at Carlisle when I went to what is still the cemetery there for those Indian children, and there are 186 of them still there.
Wow. So the cemetery's there, and you can read their names on the...
Absolutely. You know, sometimes it's the name that the school gave them, and sometimes it's their native name. Only in the last several years have some of those children been repatriated to their homelands. It's run by the U.S. military now. It's the Army War College. And for decades, the War College was not allowing that. But now, finally, some repatriation is going on, and some of the children are being repatriated to their homelands.
Which is all Jim Thorpe's family is asking for him, for his body.
The public, the world had Jim Thorpe all his life. He was a public figure, and the family just had one role, and that was at the end, to carry out his wishes and to do it in the way that he would have been proud to have done for someone else.
The battle to reclaim Jim Thorpe's body has a long legal history. His family won the right to get his body back in a U.S. district court, but a federal appeals court sided with the town and reversed the decision. The Thorpe family petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court, but it refused to hear the case. And so now, the only way Jim Thorpe's body will ever be returned to his homeland is if the town of Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, does so voluntarily.
What do you think will happen? I mean, do you think Jim Thorpe's remains will eventually return to Sac and Fox tribal lands?
I do. I do, because great things can't happen in that spot.
You're talking about the people in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania.
I am. I think at some point the younger people are going to say, I don't know what our parents and grandparents and their parents were thinking, but we can still be Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, but we don't have to hold on to his remains. Why do we have to hold him like he's a prisoner of war or a trophy?
The thing that I find so, I don't know, remarkable about this history that you're describing is you've been working on these issues for years, for decades. You keep going. You don't give up, even when things probably look kind of hopeless. And I guess I sort of wonder, you know, how do you manage to carry on and keep fighting to restore your rights and the good name and all of that?
Well, it's my job to be optimistic. I'm Cheyenne and Hodelgi Muskogee. And for the Cheyenne people, an instruction was provided to the people as a whole that the nation shall be strong so long as the hearts of the women are not on the ground. And what that means is that we have a job to be optimistic. We have a job to do, a job to get things done, and to believe that it will be done eventually because we're going to work to make it so.
Hey, y'all in it. I hope you know you've always been the one. I hope you know.
I think in a larger sense, the issue that I dealt with as a biographer is this a tragedy? And I decided that there were tragic elements to it, but that it wasn't. It was a story of perseverance. You know, how do you judge a life? How do you view a life? My late brother used to say that life is a series of sensations. And I sort of understand that. And Thorpe had some fabulous sensations throughout his life. So that's not tragic. I mean, you just think about all the people he encountered in his life, starting with playing football against Dwight Eisenhower with Omar Bradley on the bench, going to the Olympics with George S. Patton, playing baseball with Christy Mathewson, traveling the world with Hall of Famers Tris Speaker and Sam Crawford, going out to Hollywood and acting with Bob Hope and being in a movie directed by Michael Curtiz, who directed Casablanca, and having Burt Lancaster play him. I mean, you know, I think he had a lot of amazing sensations in his life and also some very difficult periods. And he did struggle with alcohol. He had 7 children, 3 wives, often didn't see his children as he was traveling around the country. So there were some elements of tragedy to it, and also some amazing, unparalleled sensations.
Jim Thorpe means to me that phrase we call indigenous excellence, embodying the human spirit in all our flaws, but still being legendary and great, and not allowing all the things that go against us in life to tear us down and stop us from being our greatest version of ourselves. That's what Jim Thorpe represents to me.
I think for such a long time, Native people and Native communities have been defined by our deficiencies. We're poor, you know, we're, if you look at educational attainment, we're at the bottom of the list. There's always somebody trying to take our land or our children, or it's always what's wrong with us. And over the past 20 years, I think as treaty rights have been asserted successfully in courts, and there's been this renewal of culture and language, especially in Native America, I think people are starting to understand that, yeah, we've got generational trauma, but generational trauma didn't help us survive. We survived because of generational joy and ingenuity and innovation and achievement. And I think there's probably nobody that better describes that than Jim Thorpe.
I'm Ann Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'd like to thank our guests today for sharing their knowledge and their hearts. Rapper Tall Paul's album is called The Story of Jim Thorpe. Go to Spotify and check it out. Tall Paul is an Anishinaabe and Oneida hip-hop artist enrolled on the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. Biographer David Marinus, author of A Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe, Activist Suzanne Shone Harjo is the recipient of a 2014 Presidential Medal of Freedom. She's Cheyenne and Hodalghi Muskogee. And Professor Patty Lowe, director of the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research at Northwestern University. She's a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Ojibwe. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour, with help from Angelo Bautista, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Mark Rickers. Our technical director and sound designer is Joe Hartke, with help from Sarah Hopeful. Additional music this week comes from Tall Paul, Randy Wood, Superman, Ketza, and Audio Res Out. Archival audio from Robert W. Wheeler and the Smithsonian. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. If you heard anything in today's show that mattered to you, I hope you'll share it. Be well, and thanks for listening. Never.